Hello, and welcome to CFA Speaks, the podcast for professionals in public finance. I'm Cal Hager, and I'll be hosting today's episode. Today on the podcast, we're discussing public sector sustainability issues. You'll hear from Jeffrey Matsu from CFA, Keith Davis from the National Audit Office, and Ravi Abewardana from the Climate Disclosure Standards Board. And just a note for our listeners, some of today's conversations were conducted during inclement weather, which unfortunately impacted internet connectivity and the quality of a few parts of today's show. Now, moving on from an ongoing challenge of working from home, stay tuned to hear more about CFA's recent report on sustainability reporting in the public sector. Up first is DEFRA Value for Money Director Keith Davis from the National Audit Office to talk about the NAO's recent report on local government and net zero in England.
I'm here with Keith Davis from the National Audit Office to discuss the recent local government and net zero in England report. Thanks for joining us today, Keith.
My pleasure.
So would you mind giving our listeners a quick overview of your background and the work that you do at the National Audit Office?
Yeah, of course. I'm a CFA qualified accountant. I've spent most of my career being involved in the assessment of public sector value for money, you know, across different parts of the public sector. For the last 4 years, I've been director of the NAO's work on DEFRA and the environment. In that time, I've led major studies on flood risk management, water resource management, packaging recycling, and air quality. At the moment, as well as the report that we've recently published that we're talking about today, our other big project at the moment is on the replacement for the Common Agricultural Policy. It's worth saying that the work around climate and the environment is certainly a big priority and an increasing priority for the NAO. Across our programme of work, we want to have a lot of pieces that address whether it's aspects of net zero, whether it's climate change adaptation, or even wider work on the environment too. And you know, we certainly expect going forward that those topics would feature prominently in our work programme.
Perfect. So turning to the reason that we wanted to have you on CFA Speaks today, the NAO recently released a report on local government and net zero in England. Would you mind giving us some background and context as to how the report came about and why the NAO investigated this particular issue?
So towards the end of last year, we published a report called Achieving Net Zero, which looked across the whole of government, across all sectors, really at what the nature of the challenge was, the risks for the country as a whole and for the public sector as a whole in achieving net zero, and try to look at what were the key features that needed to be in place for us and others to be confident that government is well set up to deliver this important target. And within that report, we talked about the importance of setting out the roles of public bodies, all of the different public bodies that are going to contribute very clearly, and the importance of the centre of government engaging effectively with all of those different parts of the public sector. So in this new report now, we've drilled further into the local government side of that question. We're looking very much at how central government and local government are working together to deliver net zero. We've been focusing on the clarity of roles and responsibilities of local government, and also whether the skills and resources are in place that are needed in local government to be able to make their contribution to delivering net zero.
All right, so it sounds like a really comprehensive overview of net zero in local government. Would you mind sharing any examples that you have from the sector?
Well, our starting point for this new piece is very much that local government has a critical role to play in delivering net zero. You know, you can illustrate that across several sectors. So if you look at transport, if you think about local government's role in terms of buses and cycling lanes or electric vehicle charging points. And if you turn to housing, if you think about the opportunities to decarbonize council housing, social housing that local government is at the center of. In the realm of waste management, local authorities are central to being able to cut methane emissions out from landfill through reducing the amount of biodegradable material that's going into landfill. So big contributions that local government can make across several sectors.
Yeah, that's great. And so kind of turning to the exciting portion of the conversation, what were the primary findings of the report?
Well, our overall conclusion was that there is an important lack of clarity in the role of local government in relation to achieving net zero. And in addition to that, we found that the funding available is provided on a very piecemeal basis. And the combination of those things, we felt, made it hard for local authorities to plan, harder for them to build up the skills and capability that they need, and also hard for them to make prioritization decisions. But breaking that down a little bit, in the area around role clarity, it's certainly the case that there's a lot of local authority commitments around net zero. But, you know, we found that the overall the role isn't clear. And we think that this creates risks to value for money. You know, certainly our experience of looking across different sectors, across different programs, tells us that where roles aren't neatly articulated and clearly and precisely articulated, then there are risks to money not being spent as well as it could, and risks to whether outcomes will be delivered. And in terms of the outcome of the commitments that our analysis showed local authorities have made, 91% of local authorities had made some sort of commitment to either decarbonize their own activities or their area. And then within that, we found 38% of single tier and upper tier local authorities had committed to decarbonizing their own area by 2030. So putting quite a tight time limit on it. And we found that there's been some central government engagement with local authorities to try to clarify their role. Several of the departments involved have worked in their sectors through workshops, consultations, et cetera, to try to involve local government in articulating and developing that role a little bit more clearly. But overall, what our report said is that that needs to be done in a much more coordinated and strategic way. And then turning to our findings around funding, we set out how there's been a significant, well, in fact, a huge increase in grant funding available to local authorities in 2020 to 21. So that's gone up to £1.2 billion. Within that, we found big variations. So 17 local authorities had had more than 20 million. 37 local authorities had less than 2 million. And then we also analysed that on a per person basis. That analysis showed us that there's 14 local authorities that had had more than £50 per person living in that area, whereas 67 local authorities had had less than £12.50 per person. And we were saying that, you know, there's no clear overall view on the totality of funding needed by local government to deliver net zero, whether that's held by Treasury or the local government ministry. Nobody had that view. The piecemeal point is very much about how the funding available is very much through local authorities having to bid competitively for grant funds. And there's two issues with that. One is that it just creates uncertainty for local authorities in terms of the funding that they're going to have available so that they can build in capability. But also, not all local authorities have equal capability themselves to make bids. Typically, the larger local authorities are probably going to be in a better place to make bids because they'll have more experience of doing that and more people they can draw on. So there are risks that smaller authorities with less capability will lose out. And then finally, we had an important finding about the reporting of progress by local authorities in delivering net zero. We found that that is quite inconsistent how local authorities go about that. And what that means is that it's quite difficult to tell the progress that they're making and to compare that to other local authorities. What we feel is that, and we recommended, that local authorities need to work together and with central government to develop some common standards for reporting so that progress can be assessed more clearly.
Right. Yeah. That mirrors much of what SIPPA found with his recent sustainability reporting research as far as the public sector goes. Now, obviously, COVID-19 continues to be the largest driver of news a year and a half later after the pandemic started. Did you find that the COVID-19 pandemic influenced your findings at all?
Well, the pandemic had understandably held government departments and local authorities back in terms of trying to make progress on net zero and in terms of coordinating their work more effectively on net zero. So, for example, the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government set up a coordinating group back in April 2020 to try to take this forward, but that had to be put on hold as resources had to be diverted into managing the pandemic. And I think just now they're beginning to kind of pick up some of that work again. I think the other thing to talk about, obviously, is local government finances and the strain that they're under. obviously local authorities have had some extra money to deal with the pandemic, but they've also had very significant extra costs. And, you know, our sense as we spoke to local authorities was that they increasingly feel that they have to focus their resources on their statutory duties. Of course, there isn't a statutory duty on net zero, and really the scope for spending on other areas is really diminishing overall as the general view.
And so, Keith, what are the NAO's recommendations going forward?
So we've got three broad areas of recommendations. The first is around central government and local authorities needing to work together to set out more clearly how key actions, decisions, and responsibilities are going to be split across the local, regional, and national level. Now, there's an opportunity to do that. Government is committed to producing both an overall net zero strategy and sector net zero strategies in time for COP26, the international conference later this year. So that's an opportunity to set out these roles and responsibilities much more clearly. As part of recommending that, we're saying that it's important that the way that that's done does reflect there are different types of local authority. So depending on whether it's urban or rural, large or small, richer or more deprived, but that doesn't stop there being a better overall articulation. And as part of that, we think, you know, there does need to be consideration of whether or not a statutory duty is needed in the area of net zero. The second area then is around funding. We think there needs to be a better overall analysis of the funding that local authorities need to deliver net zero going into the future. We acknowledge there's a lot of uncertainty. Not every type of cost they're going to incur is known with accuracy at this point in time, but a piece of work does need to be done in our view, based on the best information available now, to forecast the likely future costs. And then lastly, and it does link a little bit to the point about funding, is an analysis of the skills gaps. So that's looking at local authorities and being just a bit more precise about what additional skills and capability will they need going into the future to be able to successfully kind of make their contribution to this important national target, and then obviously what funds need to follow from that. So those are the broad areas of our recommendations.
That's a really great calls to action going forward. That's all we have time for today, Keith. Thank you so much for your time.
That was Keith Davis discussing the NAO's report on local government and net zero in England. Next, we're joined by Technical Director Ravi Abewardana from the Climate Disclosure Standards Board to discuss CIPFA's Evolving Climate Accountability Report on Sustainability Reporting Practices in the Public Sector.
So today we're joined by Ravi Abewardana from the Climate Disclosure Standards Board to talk about CIPFA's recent report on sustainability reporting in the public sector. Great to have you on CIPFA Speaks today, Ravi.
Yeah, thanks ever so much. Really excited to be here.
Now, you were a participant in part of CIPFA's research program. So I guess let's dive right in. I'm interested to hear your thoughts. What did you think about the report?
Well, where do I start? So I'm extremely pleased with the thoroughness of this report. You cover a broad range of perspectives. So you've consolidated the thoughts of academics, standard setters, auditors, and, you know, public servants, among others. And genuinely, like, the public sector sustainability reports, especially on climate, are most certainly in its infancy. And that's really alluded to within the report, and some genuine stepping stones as to how that could be addressed going forward. So overall, very pleased.
All right. That's really great to hear. Now, obviously, you're from the Climate Disclosure Standards Board. So as a standard setter, what are your views on why standards are so important whenever it comes to sustainability reporting?
So standards are extremely important. So a bit about myself. I'm a chartered accountant and just got over quite a few years under my belt. And having international financial reporting standards as a backbone to financial reporting was extremely useful to really provide that and ensure that clear and consistent messaging, you know, when an entity ultimately discloses to its users, helping them to form an opinion. So in the case of public bodies, this is often the taxpayer, that's the user. And in the case of the private sector, this is often the investor, the creditors, or the suppliers. So I really cannot stress the importance of standards and creating very much a clear and consistent message, allowing preparers to ultimately interpret what the standards want them to ultimately disclose. And then it's up to the preparer to very much communicate their message in accordance with those standards. So very useful. And then off the back of that, once they've done that, auditors have a very important role in ensuring that those disclosures, before they actually go out to the public, really do show a true and fair representation in accordance with those standards. So I think once those reports are published and it's got the rubber stamp of an auditor, the end user has a very clear and consistent picture of that particular entity and able to actually compare information across multiple different bodies. So it really gets those really core elements of trust, reducing speculation and increasing transparency. A way to actually do that is standards, and standards are extremely important from a sustainability perspective. And, you know, everything which I've just mentioned a moment ago, the same is applicable for sustainability reporting. The same principles of increasing trust and transparency is needed more than ever. You can see across the world, there's lots of sustainability issues playing out. They're having a huge impact, not only on the private sector, but also the public sector. And sharpening those public disclosures to communicate a clear and consistent message on how those public entities are adding or even eroding value associated with public goods, such as financial risks and opportunities from climate and other sustainability matters on assets which are being deployed, from my perspective, really important.
Right. And so SIPFA's research found that there were multiple different standards at the moment or frameworks that could be used to report climate information in the public sector. Now, I guess if there was a single global standard that was created for sustainability reporting in the public sector, what would be the key challenges for its development?
There are slight nuances with the actual public sector in comparison to the actual private sector. And I think we just need to be really cognizant of that. But there is a lot happening at the moment within the actual sustainability reporting space. So late last year, you had the big five standard setters, GRI, CDP, CDSB, SASB and the IIRC come together in a joint commitment to very much work collaboratively. And off the back of that, a climate standard was produced. This year, the IFRS has entered this space and they've created a technical readiness working group, which includes those five organisations, which I just mentioned a moment ago, to support them in their activities in creating the International Sustainability Standards Board. And it's really comforting to see that as an observer, IPSASB is on there as well. So with regards to your question at hand, I think it's really important that building blocks are used. So building upon the work of the IFRS in creating the International Sustainability Standards Board, but where nuances do exist, such as sustainable development goals, which, you know, often needs to be communicated in a true and fair perspective, that a sustainability standard from a public sector addresses that too. So try not to reinvent the wheel and build wherever possible.
Right. And how are sustainability standards in the public sector, how do they differ from in the private sector?
Good question. So as I mentioned a moment ago, there are slight nuances between the public sector and the private sector. The output of services can be valued using prices, for example, from a private sector, whereas from a public sector perspective, it's often the case that it's free at the point of use or subsidised nature of a public service, which prevents an equivalent method for valuing output. So public sector standard from a sustainability reporting perspective would need to assess the public money ultimately meets the policy commitment from a sustainability issue, if we focus on sustainability, not only meeting the needs of the SDGs, but at the same time appropriately disclosing the sustainability related financial risks and opportunities to current public investments, but also future policy commitments. So there are similarities with the private sector, but there are also nuances and they very much need to just be added on where possible.
Right. And now you mentioned, you know, several standard setters are working together to harmonize some of the standards or components of the standards. I guess, do you think, you know, that approach going forward is best course of action? Or do you think potentially adapting private sector standards for a public sector context and application? Or do you think the public sector needs its own standalone standard?
So I'm of the opinion that where there are similarities, they should be built upon. And with the work of the IFRS to create its proposed International Sustainability Standards Board, it is comforting to see SASB as one of the observers of the Technical Readiness Working Group. There are similarities between the private and public sector, and I think it would be very comforting to see that a building blocks approach from a public sector perspective built upon the IFRS work where possible. But where there are differences, I'm most certainly of the opinion that they very much need to be plugged. So where there are differences, guidances or additional supporting narrative should be provided to the preparer to help them plug that gap and ultimately meet the expectations of the end user from a clear and consistent disclosure.
Now, because the discipline of sustainability reporting is so broad, what do you think needs to happen to ensure that public sector organizations can properly distill down their information in a comparable way?
Sustainability is extremely broad. And from a public sector perspective, in addition to those similarities with the private sector, the public sector is unique in addition to the financial risk posed by sustainability topics. The public sector also should provide clarity on how public bodies can disclose against their contributions to, for example, the Sustainable Development Goals in a clear and consistent manner. So I wouldn't say there's a need to reinvent the wheel, but to bolt on additional elements where necessary, ultimately to support the preparer in creating those clear and consistent messages to a taxpayer, for example, as to how a particular public body is either adding value or eroding value to those SDGs, for example.
And last but not least, SIPFA's research identified 7 areas of what we like to call further consideration. So things that would help sustainability reporting become more mainstream. And that includes maybe the scope of sustainability reports, alignment and harmonization of existing frameworks, integrating with other forms of reporting, et cetera. Are there any of those 7 considerations that particularly stand out to you?
Yeah, of course. So I think it's really important from the onset to actually define and have a scope of sustainability reports. That's really important to focus minds and ensure that whatever the direction of travel for there is going forward, it is clearly outlined and defined. I do think it's very important to really build upon the excellent work of SIPFA. We really do need to be cognizant of the fact that sustainability topics are new to the majority of preparers. So we really need to be conscious of bringing them on the journey and getting them to do things which they can achievably do within their capacity. And I think it's genuinely really important to also think about possible knowledge gaps within the preparers and how that could be addressed going forward. I think out of the actual identified 7 areas for further consideration, I would add an 8th and ensure that there is some form of systems thinking where SIPFA ultimately covers a wide breadth of sustainability themes, but prioritises climate first. This is primarily because climate reached a certain level of maturity, and for that reason would be a very good starting point. But going back to my earlier point, it needs to be systems thinking. Climate can lead to other sustainability risks and opportunities, such as water. So if you're operating within an area which has been impacted by climate and temperatures are increasing, it could lead to water risks, for example. So it could be a case of water scarcity. Or there could be, because a public body needs to meet its climate commitments, there could be a case of whether the new strategy to make the public body more climate resilient could have an adverse effect on the communities which the public body serves. So just ensuring that there is a just transition is really important. Let's not try to tackle these issues in silo, but rather as an overall topic, because they are very much interrelated.
Definitely really good food for thought. So fascinating perspective. Thanks so much for joining us today, Ravi.
Thank you ever so much. Thank you.
You're listening to SIPFA Speaks, and that was Ravi Abewardana sharing his perspective on public sector sustainability reporting. Now, for the final segment of today's episode, we'll hear from SIPFA's chief economist, Jeffrey Matsu, to talk about sustainability reporting from an economist's perspective.
Thanks for joining us today, Jeff. We wanted to have you on SIPFA Speaks today to discuss SIPFA's recent report on sustainability reporting in the public sector called Evolving Climate Accountability. As SIPFA's chief economist, I'm sure you have an interesting perspective on the topic compared to, let's say, practitioners or auditors, for example. So to get things started today, what were your overall thoughts on the report?
Thanks, Cal, for inviting me to speak. I think the report was a good first step towards understanding the landscape of what sustainability and sustainability reporting in particular means for the public sector. This is a rapidly evolving area in the private sector. And while it's for the past decade in the private sector has gained rapid momentum, there are many contentious areas of reporting in the private sector. And so having perspectives on what this means and what it could mean for the public sector, I think, is particularly fascinating. I think the report did an excellent job in opening up a discussion about what practitioners within the public space are currently doing, what their aspirations are, and what their intentions are in terms of plans to report, if they have any at all. So I think rather than being positioned as a definition of what reporting is for the public sector or, you know, some definitive answer to what it should be, the report opens up what's really an important conversation for all of us to be having. And by all of us, I don't mean just the public sector. I think the private sector has a considerable vested interest in how sovereign governments report these types of activities, because ultimately, from an economic perspective at least, outcomes are based on the contributions that both public and private sector participants make.
Now, one of the seven areas of future consideration that SIPFA identified in the report focused on the need for clarity on the definition of sustainability. And meanwhile, another one of those areas of consideration focused on greater alignment among existing reporting frameworks. So from your perspective, how important are definitions and frameworks when it comes to sustainability reporting?
Reporting on sustainability will help to improve outcomes when there are clear terms of reference. As I mentioned, from ESG ratings in the private sector to the frameworks on the sustainable development goals put forth by the United Nations and adopted by the UK government, there exists a spectrum of human activity that contributes to economic growth and well-being. Of course, having said that, what might be considered sustainable to one person or group may be considered differently by another. And we come across this quite often when we talk about things that are purely green versus shades of brown. So things that might be dirty technologies like, say, coal mining, when those types of processes are done in a more environmentally friendly manner. In an absolute sense, something like coal mining will always be carbon negative. But if its carbon footprint reduces and it becomes less hazardous to the environment, then that may be something that actually contributes to sustainability. So there are different shades of what green might mean. And I think that's where definitions and frameworks really come into play. Of course, this can be amplified across time, such as when countries experience industrialization, which may, for example, lead to a sudden rapid phase of high greenhouse gas emissions. And if you look to history, it's quite informative when you see what's happened to advanced economies versus developing economies. So in the 19th and early 20th centuries, large sections of Western economies in the US and UK, for example, underwent industrialization. during those rapid phases of growth for these Western countries, there were lots of carbon intensive activities happening, which now have subsided. And many of these countries are now very focused on, well, cleaning up and taking a more sustainable path forward. But then, of course, you have countries that come after. So today, the Indias and Chinas of the world, which are rapidly industrializing, they are now having their turn at industrialization and are experiencing these rapid high levels of carbon emitting activities. So I think having definitions is important, but also having a framework and context in which to place these definitions are equally important. So by establishing a formal process for reporting activities, these differences will become exposed and open to critical judgment. So in this case, in the cases that I just mentioned, countries that may be in or about to enter a growth spurt may become reluctant to participate in such disclosures if other rules of the game are not established and agreed to well in advance. Ultimately, though, sustainability is a value-based judgment that involves activities that intersect along a continuum. Devising a framework that acknowledges these linkages while speaking a common language can be a worthwhile challenge indeed.
Right. Now, I guess turning to the component of the research, SIPFA conducted an international survey. The results of the survey that are included in the sustainability report show that only 34% of public finance professionals believed they had sufficient staffing capacity in-house to meet the requirements of sustainability reporting in the future. So only 34%. Now, at the same time, another finding was only 37% of those that are currently preparing sustainability reports believe they have the sufficient skills to do so. So, you know, there's just some bleak figures there. As an economist, you often evaluate things through the lens of incentives, resources, inequalities, et cetera. So, Jeff, what are your views on the capacity gap or issues of organizational capacity more broadly?
That's a very good point. Reporting requires a clear understanding of the framework and definitions that I just mentioned. Of course, this expertise and capacity may be particularly constrained in poor countries or local authorities in areas of high deprivation. And so some may argue that issues of sustainability become fall more on the radar of public officials once other things like sufficient food and healthcare and concerns like that are met. This can be a constraint when expertise and capacity is lacking, when overall resources are lacking. And this isn't the case just between rich and poor countries. We also know that within countries, there is a large degree of variation in resourcing amongst subnational governments. In the UK, that would be local authorities. Some local authorities, not all local authorities, and even neighboring local authorities have comparable resources. And so it's not just between countries, it's also within countries that you would see capacity constraints and capacity differences. Of course, if reporting becomes mandatory without the provision of sufficient external support, the risk for inconsistency or error may become high. Unintended consequences could include the shifting of resources away from other service areas or activities that may yield better economic or social value. So that point comes back to the one I mentioned where sustainability and issues surrounding the climate need to be scaled against other considerations, such as what's happening at an economic or social level. And so the challenge to policymakers is making sure that we get the prioritization of policy right. The cost of reporting should be evaluated, of course, against the perceived benefits and judged accordingly. There should also be a central role for quality assurance through an independent and impartial auditing body. Of course, in some jurisdictions, this may be lacking in part or whole.
So you mentioned earlier the importance of frameworks and consistent standards. Are there any particular metrics that you think should be used to evaluate the wider success of public sector organizations as sustainability reporting becomes more common?
As I mentioned previously, there's large variations in terms of the other challenges that jurisdictions may face aside from climate change and the environment. And so when we discuss metrics, it's easy to say, okay, well, let's have policies that target the reduction of overall greenhouse gases. But as we know, part of sustainability isn't just about targeting a certain amount of, say, carbon, because of course we have things like carbon credits where we need to ask ourselves, we being the public sector needs to ask itself, are we aiming for carbon reductions, for example, or would carbon displacement, meaning one country buys carbon credits from another country so that the overall amount of carbon that's being emitted globally stays the same? Do we consider that type of metric to be helpful if overall levels of carbon aren't decreasing? That's a question that policymakers need to ask themselves. Measures of sustainability will need to be well-defined and structured so that progress in reporting can be monitored at regular intervals. That's very critical, that it's not just once a year or once every few quarters. Sustainability is something that we need to reflect on a regular basis and align with other policy outcomes that are desired for any given society. The rate of change in activities is also important, and in many ways just as important as the levels. So if the absolute level of, say, carbon emissions is only modestly decreasing, but for a particular activity within government, one component has had a significantly larger decrease than others, that's worth noting in the metrics. And so that could be considered a success for that particular activity that's being monitored. And so we need to make sure that we're not just looking at the total, but that we're assessing the activities within the total, so the parts. And finally, mechanisms should exist to recognize the value in reporting activities that contribute indirectly to improved outcomes as well. So again, looking at improvements, the rate of change, not just the total level.
Right. Jeff, the last thing I'd like to get your perspective on today is demand. So the demand for sustainability reporting in the private sector is largely driven by investors, and some would likely argue consumers as well. It's less clear in the public sector as to where the demand for sustainability reporting is coming from. So are there any factors or strategies that could be used to increase the demand for sustainability reporting in the public sector? That way we see, you know, the practice become more mainstream sooner rather than later.
I think that's a fair question to ask. Sustainability reporting in the private sector has been led by investor and consumer demand rather than regulation. The public sector needs to ask itself whether adopting a similar approach makes sense. Of course, we know that government services step in when the private markets don't lead to optimal outcomes and maybe there's some market failure. And in the case of climate change related issues, that's certainly a case. So there may be scope for more regulation in the public sector. But having said that, there are incentives in terms of creating demand for this type of reporting. And that may be driven by credit ratings, in the sense that if credit rating agencies score sovereigns based on their performance on specified sustainability metrics, the ones that are discussed in the report, then that would be reflected in a country's ratings, which would then influence investor behavior. And that would in itself affect capital flows, global capital flows, which would influence the kinds of activities that national and subnational governments are engaged in. So private and institutional investors can affect how governments behave through credit rating mechanisms, because ultimately governments need to borrow from financial markets. And so if their access to credit is dependent on their ability to measure and report their sustainability performance, then that in theory would increase the number of countries that report, not just countries, but I should say governments at different levels. Equally, governments could leverage the populism of the past decade to enhance civic participation in, albeit a more holistic manner. There may be a natural tendency for policymakers to favor regulation as a means to achieving widespread reporting, but to endure, local governments will also need to see clear value. And so on this last point, I would just emphasize, as is mentioned in our report, that there is this symbiotic relationship between levels of government. There are elements of reporting that need to be sorted out as to what gets reported at what level of governance. It can't just be central government reporting. There needs to be a clearly defined role of how local governments get involved in this.
Really interesting perspective on how to shift the balance of power and influence demand. Thanks so much for your time and sharing your thoughts today, Jeff.
Thank you very much, Cal.
You've been listening to SIPFA Speaks. Thanks again to Jeffrey for joining us on the show. That wraps up today's episode. We hope you found it interesting and insightful, and we'll see you again next time.